യോഗേന ചിത്തസ്യ പദേന വാചാം മലം ശരീരസ്യ ച വൈദ്യകേന യോപാകരോത്തം പ്രവരം മുനീനാം പതഞ്ജലിം പ്രാഞ്ജലിരാനതോസ്മി സ്തുവേ പതഞ്ജലിം വ്യാസം ശങ്കരം ച മുനിത്രയം കർത്തൃസൂത്രസ്യ ഭാഷ്യസ്യ ക്രമാത് വിവരണസ്യ ച. So last time we discussed some of the characteristics of vrittis, their formations, and also this cycle, how actions give birth to modifications called vrittis, which become samskaras, which become vasanas, which later become sankalpa or action, and then again vritti. So this cycle. In fact, if we want to know the nature of our internal personality, we can keep this in mind. See, apart from our physical personality, there's an internal, subtle personality which is very powerful. In Vedantic tradition, the subtle personality, what we really are, consists of 15 plus 2 elements. 15 elements are the 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, then the 5 dimensions of vital energy, mind and intellect. So what we are in reality is not the physical body, but something which is invisible, which is more subtle. The physical body only is a gross dimension of our real personality. So to give you an example, our mind, as I said earlier, is a bag which contains, in subtle form, tendencies and impressions that we gather from every action in every life. So every action produces a modification, a subtle residual factor, which becomes a potent tendency, which again becomes a tendency towards action called vasanas. And this tendency later makes us do certain things, and those actions again produce tendencies. This cycle continues. This is the human, this is the nature of human personality, which is called vritti samskara chakram. This is what Patanjali calls it. The commentators on Patanjali's Yoga Sutra calls it vritti samskara chakram. Easy to understand. Chakram means a wheel. Vritti is nothing but a modification. Whatever we do, that action comes to an end the moment we complete the action. But then, how is it possible for us later on to be prompted to do the same action, depending upon the result of all these actions? If it is pleasant, we will be prompted to run away to avoid that action. If it is associated with a pleasant, happy result, we'll be tempted to repeat the same action. That means an invisible, subtle force is created, which Patanjali calls by a very interesting and psychologically very profound name. It is called karmashaya. That is a very famous psychological concept in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Karmashaya it is called. To give an example, whatever we do, whatever actions we do, produces two kinds of effects. One is the individual effects in the form of a samskara. As I said earlier, if you have done something and if its result is very happy one, then we will have a tendency to repeated action, even when it is not necessary. And if it is associated with an unpleasant result, the same tendency will act in the opposite way. We will try to avoid that action. Avoiding an action is also a manifestation of the vritti produced by a previous experience, which again, previous action. So this is the microcosm, the individual dimension of samskara. It's called the microcosmic dimension of karmashaya. If you are interested, you will find this in the 12th sutra of Sadhana Pada, means the second chapter of Patanjali Yoga Sutra book, the second chapter, not the chapter that we are dealing with. Because when we discuss this book, we had to refer to many other sutras from other chapters. There is one sutra for those of you who have got a book, you can refer. 12th sutra of second chapter, that is Sadhana Pada. Klesha Moolaha Karmasiyo Drishta Adrishta Janma Vedaniyaha. This is the sutra. The meaning is this. Whatever we do, we have to reap the harvest, if not in this life, next life. That's what it means. Adrishta means if not, not in this life, next life. Some of you may have felt it when you go to a holy place, a pilgrim center. You must have been thinking for a long time. And when you reach the pilgrim center, a holy place, suddenly you may have a feeling, well, you have come back to a place which sometime in the past belonged to. You had some association, the Deva, Ju, some expression is in French. What's that word? Deja vu. Deja vu, I'm sorry. Thank you for correction. Deja vu. You feel that, well, you have been here sometime in the past. Or you may feel you have seen the person. This is not an abnormality. Or somehow you had some previous experience with this place, with this person, with this idea. In fact, that is the mystery, that is the explanation of the so-called geniuses. Some people who can learn things very fast. There is nothing supernatural about it. One of the unique contributions of Patanjali is, he says, supernatural, belief in supernatural things is a superstition. Patanjali says it's all scientific. So when you are not able to find a scientific, rational explanation, you call it superstition. Something that you cannot explain in terms of the knowledge that we have got right now, the reason and logic that we have got at your disposal. Now, Patanjali says there is a reason for it. Because whatever action we do, it produces two types of effects. One effect is individual effect in the form of samskara. We have a tendency to repeat action or to avoid action. We feel we have been here, we have seen this person, we have read this book, we have had some acquaintance with this idea. We can't explain it. According to Vedanta philosophy, when you remember certain things with names and forms, then that memory is related to an experience in this life, which a psychologist can try to trace with the help of hypnotism. When you remember something which you cannot explain, which is totally unrelated to any of your experiences in this life, then it comes from another source. That another life, and that memory comes as an idea, as a concept, not as a concrete memory. Concrete memory is related to an experience in this life, which is accompanied by name and form. We remember the name, we remember the form. The other one may be coming from another source, an abstract idea. So that's why sometimes we are able to learn certain ideas. We are able to learn science or philosophy, depending on music, whatever may be, as we feel that it is we are revising a lesson that we learned in the past. This is an example of the individual effect of samskara, which is the microcosm of the karmashaya. The other one is macrocosm, the cosmic effect, in the form of karmic residue known as apurva and adrishta. I shall explain this because this idea should be kept in mind when we proceed further from where he have reached. Adrishta and apurva is nothing but the cosmic effect of what we do, which we are not able to recognize at the time of action. The word itself, adrishta in Sanskrit, means not seen or unseen. Apurva means something which did not exist earlier. So when we do a good action, an unselfish action, a potency is created. And this is the main doctrine of a school of ancient Indian philosophers called the Mimamsas. So a potency, a residual effect is created when we do a noble, an unselfish act. It's not seen, so it is called adrushta, unseen. That's a literal translation. Apurva means something which did not exist earlier. It comes into effect. In fact, those of you who do some introspection can feel it. Well, suppose you are walking the street. Give a very concrete example. An aged person who is in need of some help is looking for somebody to help him, and we volunteer, we come forward and help him out of a problem. And he feels kind of an inner feeling of gratitude. That action suddenly produces a spiritual capital. This is an example of the microcosmic universal effect of karmashaya, the residual effect of an action. Now, in this sutra, Patanjali says, whatever we do, we will have to enjoy or suffer depending upon the type of actions we do. If not in this life, in next life. That's a drishta, adrishta. Drishta means in this life. Drishta means seen, the present life. Adrishta means some other life. Swami Vivekananda, in his interpretation, if you read Swami Vivekananda's commentary, you find he says, when we do something very bad, extremely bad, which creates a lot of problems for so many people, the effect of that evil action is felt and experienced in this life and within a short time. Similarly, when we do something really very good, its positive effect also is experienced in this life. What Patanjali says is this: whatever we do, that produces a vritti and a samskara in its macrocosmic universal dimension. It is added to a capital. And in the next life, we will be able to enjoy the results. So this is an important concept in Patanjali's system, which has got a great ethical value. I give an example. When we do something noble, we will have a soothing effect in our inner mindset. We'll have done something. That's why people, rich people, who may have made money maybe through questionable means, at one stage may feel well, we must make a big donation for some, maybe for eradication of Ebola in some African countries, or AIDS, or for women's emancipation movements, for education of the poor people, helping the third people in the third world countries, and so on. You know why they do that? When they do it, they will have a cooling, soothing effect in their mind system. Suddenly, they are able to produce a big, huge quantity of spiritual capital. And that will have a cooling, a tranquilizing effect in their mind system. They may call it satisfaction, they may call it peace, or whatever it may be. Even if it is done for name and fame, still it will have the effect. That's why people feel like doing something good for others after making fabulous wealth. So that's why Patanjali says, Klesha Moolaha Karmasyo Drishta Adrishta Janma Vedaniyaka. Means, whatever we do, we enjoy or suffer, if not in this life, in the next life. So, in other words, these actions is result. That is, vrittis, actions and their modifications will produce a tendency, a potency, and again that tendency will influence action. Frequently, you know, our actions influence our thoughts, thoughts influence actions. This may need some explanation. We know very well that mind decides thoughts, and thoughts may determine the type of actions we do. But how do actions determine mind and thoughts? The explanation is given by Patanjali through this sutra. That is, when we do something good, that good action produces an unseen result at the microcosmic level, individual level. It produces a positive samskaras. And that positive samskaras will purify our mind, and that influences thoughts, and good, noble, holy thoughts are produced, which eventually lead to good actions. That's why actions influence mind, and mind again influences actions. So both take place simultaneously. Now, this is called the vritti samskara chakra. Samskara means tendencies. Vritti means modifications. We do some actions. Actions produce a residual tendency. And that tendency becomes a potency, which goes deeper, which becomes a collective capital of either good tendencies or bad tendencies, depending upon what we do. So this cycle continues. So when we are going to discuss the question of restraining these modifications and purifying these modifications, before we take up that subject, this cycle of vritti samskara chakram, the wheel of vritti and samskara, actions, tendencies, potencies, again leading to action, this cycle should be kept in mind. So, to give a more complete description of this cycle, as I explained earlier, when whatever we do produces a modification, a residual effect, these residual effects eventually constitute our character. We say totality of samskaras, or tendencies or potencies. Depending upon these samskaras, our mind is prone to do certain things, good or bad. That mindset, that is the samskara, which is oriented towards an action, is called vasana. So depending upon the samskaras, we develop some vasanas. Natural tendency to do certain things, that is vasana. Natural tendency to do certain things, that is vasana. So this vasana makes us to take a decision. It creates a will to do certain things, which is called sankalpa, Sanskrit. All these are used in Buddhist tradition, Buddhist philosophy also. And this sankalpa is will to do things. This will to do things leads to action. So this is the cycle. And actions again produce modifications. Modifications produce samskaras. Samskaras produce vasanas. Vasanas lead to will, sankalpa. Will lead to actions. Action again produce modifications. So this cycle continues. This is what you call vritti samskara chakram, as Patanjali calls it. Now, a commentator on Patanjali's system has given some elaborate descriptions, which I'll describe later. Now we are coming to an important subject, that is today's subject for discussion. We have reached the last of the vrittis, because Patanjali said there are total 5 types of vrittis: pramana, vibhariya, vikalpa, nidra, smritayaka. All modifications are related to either one or any of these 5 types. The first one is pramana. We already explained, but I'm just doing some kind of recapitulation. Valid knowledge. We see certain things. We infer certain things. We read from books certain things. And all these will have their effect in our mindset. That is one type of vritti. The second vritti is wrong knowledge. That also is a vritti. Because a flash of thought in the mind, which may not be real, can also produce its modification. Then a concept, an idea without a corresponding object, also can be a vritti. Sleep also can be a vritti, according to Patanjali's system. The fifth one is smriti, memory. That's what we are going to discuss now. Memory, because that's again related to sleep. According to Patanjali's commentators, human memories of two types. One is imagined, the other is unimagined. Some memories are related to dream. Some memories are related to waking state. Certain modifications, mental tendencies, which are related to real life experiences, which are related to waking state, and certain memories which are imagined is related to dream state. Here we have to remember the Vedanta philosophy says that whatever we dream cannot be completely unrelated to some experience we have in the waking state. We cannot have any dream experience which is totally unrelated to some or other experience in waking state. In waking state, it could come as an idea. In dream state, it may happen with name and form in a very graphic manner. You can hear, you can see, all this happen. In dream, you could imagine walking under burning sun, but you are sleeping in a dark room. So mind projects all these memories, which are called bhavita, which Vyasa calls it bhavita, means imagined, related to imagination. But imagination cannot take place in a vacuum. Every imagination has a background of some reality. Imagination is not an exact duplication of reality, but it's never totally unrelated to reality. So, according to Vedanta, which explains certain things which are not fully explained in Patanjali's system, according to Vedanta, whatever we dream is one way or other related to waking state experiences. But they are not exact duplication. In waking state, it takes 6 hours from here to New York. But in dream, it takes only a split second. But same again, in waking state, you cannot think of a big plane or a truck in a small room. But in dream, you are experiencing the movement of a plane or a truck in your own mind, a small room. Because in dream state, mind projects at a mental level subtle memories which it has gathered from waking state experiences. So there are differences, but one can never have any dream experience which is totally unrelated, because in waking state, we imagine going from place to place. We may have gone, or we may have thought, or we may have read about it. Whatever ideas we gather in waking state are reproduced, are re-experienced in subtle form at the mental level in dream state. So, and these experiences also become vrittis, and they become modifications, they become samskaras, they lead to repetition of actions, and they also become part of this cycle. Now, in the 12th sutra of the first chapter, that is Samadhipada, Patanjali gives an interesting explanation of how to restrain these modifications. We have to remember, he defines yoga as chitta vritti nirodha. In our life, in our experiences, day-to-day experiences, we identify our sense of self with the modifications that emerge in our mind, in our visual or audio experiences. Whatever experiences we have with the 5 senses of perception, 5 senses of action, and mind, whatever experiences we have, we identify ourselves with those modifications that emerge as a result of these experiences. And as a result of this, we suffer, we enjoy. When something unpleasant happens, we completely forget what we are, and we identify ourselves with that unpleasant experience that leads to problems. Now, how to stop, how to restrain these modifications or disidentification with modifications? Patanjali's prescription is Abhyasa Vairagya Abhyam Tad Nirodhaka. He prescribes 2 methods, Abhyasa and Vairagya. Abhyasa means steady practice. Vairagya means total dispassion or detachment. We are going to explain this. Of course, in this context, as I mentioned earlier, we have to take another important verse from another chapter, that is Ishvara Pranidhanatva is a very interesting prescription is given in the same sutra. If you resign everything to God, if you surrender ourselves to God, then that act of self-surrender is enough for us to stop this misidentification with the emerging modifications in our mind. The point is this: when we surrender ourselves completely to a divine spiritual ideal, that becomes a constant memory in our mind. So whenever we do something that could lead to undesirable consequences, when we feel like being tempted to do undesirable things, this memory of complete surrender to God will always accompany our mind. It will act as a stumbling block in our doing something undesirable, something evil. So, and again, we will always remember, we will always interpret ourselves as a spiritual seeker who has surrendered ourselves to God. So this memory becomes a great help in restraining this misidentification with modifications. So here in this context, some of the commentators compare mind to a river. And he says, this river of human mind flows in both directions, good and bad. Sometimes we find mind is moving towards positive tendencies, positive ideas. Sometimes mind is moving in the opposite direction. Yatu kaivalya pragbhara viveka vishaya nimna. So there are long descriptions. Sometimes this river moves, flows towards spiritual liberation, towards peace and tranquility and inner peace. Sometimes this same mind moves in the opposite direction. You can see this. So at that time, if you remember, well, God will look after everything. God will see everything. And this idea of God as a divine spiritual being will act as a great help and will force this river of human mind flow in the direction to a spiritual liberation. This idea behind. So once we achieve this level of complete restrainment, then we should continue this practice. So every time when the mind flows in the opposite direction, we have to remember, I am not a slave of the senses. Senses are my servants. That is an important thing. Mama ede vasya na aham edesham. It's a very famous statement by the commentator, Commentator Vyasa, who is a Sanskrit commentator on Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. He says, Mama ete vasya, these senses, these external visual or audio objects which try to tempt my mind, drag my mind in the direction of sensory, worldly pleasures, they should not be my masters. They are within my control. The commentators say that if you do not try to control our senses, the senses will become merciless, cruel tyrants. So there is no other alternative. If you want to have peace of mind, the first step is to stop the tyranny of the senses. If we do not try to control the senses and put the senses under our control, then senses will put us under their control. In one of our ancient scriptures, there is a wonderful description of how senses drag human mind towards total destruction. This verse comes in an ancient Sanskrit book, Vedanta, by Shankaracharya. Shabdadibhi panchabhireva pancha panchatamapasa gunena baddhaha kuranga madanga padanga meenaha bhringa nara panchabhiranchidakim. It's an ancient Sanskrit verse. If those of you are interested can see in Viveka Chudamani, it comes there. It's a wonderful description of the total tyranny of the senses and how this tyranny leads to our complete destruction and enslavement and anxiety neurosis, depression, suicide tendencies, all that. That is explained here. The poet takes the example of five creatures from the animal kingdom. The deer, the elephant, the moth, fish, and some smaller creatures which go from maybe honeybees, from flowers to flowers, collecting honey from different flowers. Now, here is an interesting imagery. First, it takes the example of deer. Now, in ancient times, these hunters used to hunt down deers, kill deers in forest. They used to play they used to play on a musical instrument. Hearing this music, the deers will be hiding in a cave or a bush, will come out. At that time, the hunter will shoot it with arrow and kill it. And then, now here, the deer is caught and is destroyed because of his infatuation to the audio objects. Means when the sound came, it was tempted, it was attracted, it came out, it was killed. Now this is a very symbolic, philosophical description of the tyranny of the senses. The other example is elephant. Now elephants move in herds, you know, huge, big groups, they move. The female elephant will hold the babies, that's how they move. So the elephants moving in groups, they touch each other and they fall in a pit prepared by the hunters. And they also lose their freedom and they are killed or enslaved. And then moths, they emerge in large numbers after the rainy season. When they see the fire burning at a distance, they think this is something very wonderful and they fly towards them and they are killed. They are burnt ashes. Then fish. Fish is tempted by the bait and it's caught and it's killed. And again honeybees. They are attracted by the beautiful smell of flowers and at that time some other creatures come and kill them. Now the poet finally asked the question, Narapanjabhiranchitakim, that's the meaning. It means in the case of human beings, all the time, all the five senses, our eyes, our ears, our sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, as the case of fish, all these five senses are simultaneously dragging the mind towards external objects. So what a tragedy, what the plight of human beings is so tragic. So every moment, every second, these senses, five senses of perception, are dragging the mind towards different objects. And so long as we identify ourselves with these objects, we will have no peace of mind. Because we identify ourselves with every momentary experience. We forget that momentary experience is only momentary. When something unhappy, something tragic happens, we are completely upset because we identify ourselves with that tragic event. And as a result, we forget that it is a momentary experience. No experience in human life is a permanent state of permanent. Everything is in a flux. So every momentary happy or unhappy experience and modifications is identified with our own reality. And we forget that we are something beyond this body and mind. And as a result, we suffer. So that's why the commentator says, so long as we are under the tyranny of the senses, there will be no peace of mind. So the first method is to practice dispassion. Dispassion means you may find sometimes the word used, dispassion. Dispassion here means we should not identify ourselves with these momentary experiences. So in the Buddhist tradition, it's called Kshanikavada. It's an important doctrine in Buddhist idealistic philosophy, in both Shunyavada, that is doctrine of emptiness, and also in Yogacara, Vijnanavada system, the subjective idealism. Now, everything is momentary. But what really happens, so long as we are under the control of the senses, the momentariness of worldly experience is completely forgotten, and we identify ourselves with all these momentary experiences, and as a result, we lose our peace of mind. So the only way out, according to Patanjali, is the practice of repeated practice of this effort to restrain this misidentification with the emerging modifications, and the practice of dispassion. This is called vairagya. It's a very important principle here. Now, in this context, he explains that this should be practiced for a long time and taught it, and with a sense of unbroken continuity. And the commentators make an interesting point. If you want to practice this dispassion continually and without a break, then you should love this practice. So in this context, we have to sublimate our natural human tendencies to higher spiritual level. Our natural restlessness, anxiety, our eagerness, all should be elevated to a higher spiritual foundation, and then we'll be able to practice it with continuity and sincerity. When we reach this stage, we reach the highest level of renunciation or dispassion. So in the 15th verse, Patanjali says, Drishta anusraviga vidrushnasya vashigara samjnya vairagyam. So dispassion is explained here. What is dispassion? We should not have any craving, any desire for anything belonging to this life, anything related to earthly pleasures. It's a big thing to ask for. And we should not have desire for heavenly pleasures. So one important requirement of peace of mind is we should have no desire. Or the desire should be sublimated. The other way to explain this is, see, if somebody tells you, well, you should not have any desire for anything, we should not have any aim in life, it's difficult to understand unless we reach a very high level of spiritual evolution. So some of the commentators give some helpful clues. He says, we should try to sublimate, elevate our natural tendencies to a higher level. And when we reach that stage, slowly we will have a tendency to give up desire for earthly pleasures. The moment we understand that earthly pleasures will not bring eternal joy and happiness, then we won't go after that. We may need them, people may use them, but people will not be enslaved. They will not be obsessed with worldly pleasures. That's the idea. People may need them, they may get them, but we will not be enslaved or be obsessed with worldly pleasures. And for that, Patanjali gives an interesting and very helpful, psychologically very helpful clue. Lift, raise, or sublimate your desire, your aim. Create in your mind a strong desire for higher spiritual values. For that, we must know what is eternal, what is non-eternal. In the Vedantic tradition, this is explained a little more elaborately. The first step in spiritual life is we must know what is real, what is unreal. Because we will never be obsessed with something that we know to be unreal. If people are extremely greedy, it means they think that money can bring them something which will stay with them all the time. if they are after name and fame, then they may be under the impression that name and fame will give them something which will stay with them all the time. So once we understand the perishable nature, the momentariness of worldly pleasures, then slowly we will have a desire, an inclination towards higher things. After all, we will have a desire, we will have an inclination only for something that is really worthwhile. So, that's why Patanjali says, dispassion of the person in whom the craving for earthly and heavenly pleasures is completely ceased, that state is called the highest level of dispassion, which is called Vashikara Vaira, Samnya Vairakyam. That's the technical term used in Sanskrit, the sutra, the 15th sutra of the first chapter, Samadhipada. Here, one interesting point is that drishta here means earthly pleasures. We can understand. Adrishta means heavenly. The point is, even desire for enjoying heavenly pleasures will make us a slave of the senses. The purpose is to escape from the tyranny of the senses, because freedom given to the senses leads to spiritual slavery. Freedom from the senses leads to spiritual liberation. And freedom from the tyranny of senses is real dispassion. Now, we cannot have complete freedom from the tyranny of the senses if we are interested even in heavenly pleasures. Here, of course, I have to explain this. When you read these translations, there is a possibility for some misunderstanding. The concept of heaven, as Patanjali uses here, adrishta means heavenly pleasures, is not the same heaven as mentioned, as explained in monotheistic religions. In monotheistic religions, heaven is always associated with the spiritual achievement, place of God. It's a kind of higher spiritual illumination. But in Patanjali system, heavenly pleasures means a desire to do good things so that we can have wonderful things above, after death, which is not a permanent state. In monotheistic religions, heaven is a permanent state. You don't come back because there is no belief in reincarnation or rebirth. But in Patanjali system and Vedanta system, you often come across this idea. We should not have any desire for heavenly pleasures. So heaven in Vedanta system and Patanjali system has got a different connotation. This heaven is an extension. Heaven, according to yoga and Vedanta system, is an extension of worldly pleasures in this world. You live for longer life, you have much better enjoyments, that's all. And so long as we have any desire for any sensory worldly enjoyments, we can never have dispassion. And without dispassion, without sublimation of our desires for higher things, we will never be able to stop this misidentification with the modifications of the senses. And so long as we are not able to stop it, we will be completely under the tyranny of the senses. This idea behind. So we have described quite a few things and have used some technical terms which we can't help it. In most of the expositions in English language on yoga philosophy, you find these terms are used: karmashaya, vritti, samskara, sankalpa, all these terms are used. But those who are not familiar with these terms can ask me questions and we'll have an interesting interaction, discussion. Feel free to ask questions.
That triggers a thought and that triggers an action. So, but when you say
Yes. Now, in the description, further descriptions of four levels of dispassion, you find in the system four levels of dispassion, yatamana, vitireka, and so on. He says we should constantly break the link between impulses and memories. See, very often we feel we are tempted, we feel like going after sensory pleasures, worldly pleasures, due to memory. Old actions, previous actions. And then there's a natural impulse of the mind to go after these things. Now, they come together, impulses and memories, they connect. See, for example, to give an example, a person who has enjoyed a lot of worldly pleasures, who was interested only in worldly pleasures, takes to spiritual life. Now, after many years of spiritual life, when he finds himself in a set of circumstances where his old impulses will revive in his mind along with memories. So his natural impulse, which is not fully restrained, when these impulses connect with the previous memories, memories related to previous actions, he will be tempted to repeat, to go along the same path as he was doing in early life, before taking to spiritual life. Now, at one stage, through constant practice of this dispassion, this link connecting impulses, natural human tendencies and impulses of worldly pleasures and memories of previous life should be broken. Once you break this, your dispassion becomes solid. That's the purpose. How to do this? By constantly thinking about the evil effects of undesirable activities. Constant thinking. And again, by enriching the mind with positive tendencies, positive impressions, associating with people with whom a conversation may introduce you to new spiritual ideas, reading books, visual activities, audio activities, conversations, associations, all should be given a spiritual orientation. It is called, sublimation of desires, sublimation of anxieties. Our mind never remains quiet. Mind is always active. As I said, mind is, that's why it is compared to a river. It could flow in one direction, it could flow in the other direction. So we cannot forcibly take the mind in one direction. But we can do that by constantly feeding the mind with good ideas, good thoughts, good impressions, so that mind will slowly become more and more enriched with positive tendencies. And once this happens, old memories and impulses will not connect. Memories may come, impulse may be there, but immediately when they are about to connect, we can break the link, so it will be bad for us. Why? Because we are associating with spiritual people, reading spiritual books, feeding the mind with spiritual ideas. They become a great restraining force. Very rational, scientific way. So that's why I mentioned earlier, any noble, good action, even with desire for name and fame, is good than doing nothing. If you donate a few billions of dollars for a great noble cause, and if you want your name to be printed in all newspapers, it's better to do that than doing nothing. doing nothing for anybody. Because this will take you to one level of spiritual growth. And after several such efforts, you will do the same good thing. You will make the donation. You won't insist that your name should be published. So that's an interesting, there's a constant evolution from step one to step two. So that's why this Karmasaya doctrine has got a profound implication. Karmasya is nothing but a huge bag of samskaras, divided into two categories, microcosm and macrocosm. Whatever good things we do, it will have an effect in our own mindset. If we keep doing good things, naturally we will have a tendency to avoid doing undesirable. Because the mind has already accumulated a lot of good samskaras. So mind has started flowing in one direction. It won't flow in the opposite direction. That's a microcosm. At the macrocosmic level, it produces a spiritual capital which will remain with you. That's why in the Gita says, if not in this life, the next life, we will reap the harvest if you have sown good seeds. That's the idea. That action will remain. It's called adrishta, invisible potency. In fact, this will have one psychological effect on human mind. We will have a soothing effect. When you do something noble, something fine, something unselfish, we may lose a lot of money while doing some these noble, unselfish activities, a lot of time and energy. But we know why people do that. They get some inner contentment, which we can't buy with money in the markets. That is very precious. So that means the adrishtam, the apurvam, that the invisible, subtle, spiritual capital is created. And according to Patanjali system, that will decide our destiny next life. No action will remain fruitless. Whatever we do, it will produce effect. That is it. Drishta, adrishta, he says, not in this life, next life, you have to enjoy or suffer. That's the idea. Yes. Please, come.
So we're talking about good actions versus bad actions, right? And but they can be very subjective. A good action for me may not necessarily mean a good action for someone else. And bad action.
Well,
so what is the universe?
I'll tell you one subjective truth. Every genuine person will have his inner mind telling him this is good. A genuine person will have a very subjective understanding of what is proper, what is right. Whatever we do may not be good for everyone. See, a policeman is doing not a good for the criminal. A criminal would not appreciate the good actions of a policeman, and the other way around. But, so that's why there cannot be any action which will have an identical result for everyone, effect on everybody. So, in fact, that is one of the signs that humanity is one, existence is one, Atman is one. In everyone, there is an inner voice that tells him or her, this is right or this is wrong. At one point or other, it happens. So, I don't think any genuine person will consult all books or law books or constitutions to decide whether telling truth is right or good or no. Dharma, our duty, truthfulness, what we do should be good for others according to our understanding. That everyone knows. Logically, we cannot define or explain this. But everyone at one level has a subjective feeling that this is the right thing to do.
But that subjective feeling is also coming from our own samskara.
Maybe. You see, that's true. But mostly, except for hardcore criminals, Every thief has a feel, knows that thieving is not a good thing to do, stealing is not a good thing to do. All these activities which are bad for other members of the society are not good things to do. Everyone knows. That there is no doubt about. That's why, in fact, the criminologists are able to make people talk because of this problem. Because in many cases, many people, most, even the hardcore criminals have a feeling that they are doing something which is not all right. They may have a justification for it, but still there is a feeling that it's not all right. So I don't think a student needs to be told that studying is his duty, is good thing for others, or a professor, teacher has to be told that teaching is his job. No, I don't. So that's way. So at one level, you find once we start doing good things, slowly we find many of the doubts that we entertained earlier will vanish. We will have doubts only before we take the first step. When we take the first step, then we won't have any more doubts. Because life can never be fully defined and logically analyzed. Human life or the working of our mind can never be logically analyzed through any interaction. So once we start doing something unselfish, something good, immediately the mind slowly starts moving in the positive direction. And mind itself becomes its own teacher. That's the instruction which Sri Ramakrishna gave Swami Vivekananda's teacher, Guru Chet. Mind at one point becomes your teacher. But mind itself slowly takes you in the right direction. Once we start doing something good, something normal. Yes, please, please.
It seems like even in the realm of any action, even positive action, there's still at times a negative, unintended consequence. So my intention may, and I can give an example that doesn't make sense, but a lot of times you go out and you set forth to do something in a positive way, even with some level of sacrifice, but there's still a point where it splinters and there are negative consequences to those good actions. Some can say Mahatma Gandhi was a great leader for the Indian people, but he was not a very good father. In the humanitarian world, you go out and you set forth to do all these acts of service to ease the suffering for the poor, but in a lot of times in those actions, you have to feed the evil, powerful people to get access in, so then it also perpetuates a problem. So my one question is, what stems the karmic burden from that?
Yes, as I said earlier, you know, most of the conflicts are related to these conflicting, accumulated karma and its residual effects. Our mind is, our character, mind is like a bag. It contains good actions and the results and good tendencies, and also bad actions and their tendencies, their results. So when we take a decision to do good things, intellectually we sincerely want to do things. But then when we try to do, there's an invisible mental block. It's called mental block. So there is a conflict between will and mind. An intellectual will, a decision, we want to do something. But when we try to do that, it's not a physical or visible obstacle which we can easily overcome. An invisible mental, subjective mental block, which is difficult to overcome. This is due to the conflict. Means conflict between these two warring groups, good tendencies and bad tendencies, which have accumulated in the mind stuff, mental system. There is only one way out. You increase the quantity of good tendencies.
Realize till after the fact that kind of like a, you know, a complete active seva. And then it's only after the fact when you reflect on what actually transpired in those actions that you realize, no, it actually, in truth, was not all entirely, it didn't have all entirely a positive consequence. But in some ways, you've also perpetuated certain problems.
Well, well, I will come back to Gandhi now to explain this. I will come to Gandhi now. That gives a very wonderful answer. Gandhi was a great man, a great leader. As you mentioned, some people say that he was not a good father. He was not a doting father in the sense he had a higher concern for humanity, higher value. So he cared much more for the whole world of humanity at large than just spending all the time working for the welfare of his own individual family. Now, here we have to remember, people raise these objections. He never had any conflicts. See, remember that. So more subjective. So far as Gandhi was concerned, he was so well established in total unselfishness in his ideal of nonviolence. There were many people who were not in full agreement with his nonviolence and all that. But so far as he was concerned, he had no doubt. He was free from any conflict. He was absolutely well established. One disciple of Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa said Gandhi was a great yogi. He was visiting one of our ashramas in India, and one of Swami Vivekananda's brother disciples, another disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, watched him. He said he was knocking at the door of Brahman, means he was about to realize the absolute reality. Here the point is, we feel this conflict, but Gandhi never felt it. So if a person sincerely believes that what he does is good for himself, for others, it won't bring any evil to anybody. Still, even if it brings some unexpected results, undesirable consequences for some people, we need not worry. We won't worry. Because it's just subjective here. So we should not analyze, oh, I did so much good for others. Could it have harmed somebody else? We should not go about thinking like that. We should be subjective. So Gandhi's life itself is an answer to this question. He never had any conflict. That's because he was fully convinced on what he was doing, and he believed that it was good for the world. It was good for the world. He was much higher than many loving parents who won't care for the next door neighbors. But Gandhi looked for the welfare of the whole humanity. So he was much superior, much greater than the most affectionate parents of the world who never cared for even their own next door neighbors. So what I want to tell you, here it is subjective. Without bothering much about the possible undesirable consequences to some people, we should focus on doing good things. Doing good things need not necessarily mean physical involvement in any charitable activities. Reading good books, praying, or in any voluntary activities, which you do with total unselfishness. You won't worry, oh, I went to a church or a Vedanta society, I helped them in doing their work. Could it have caused any harm to somebody else? We won't think that way. We do something noble and we feel a soothing effect in our mind.
into war because he felt like very justified. But there's still the reality of the consequences and the harm of that.
Yes.
But he
So I tell you, I fully agree with you. Yes, yes. So here, from a spiritual point of view, we should not push the logic and philosophy beyond the limit, because logic and philosophy and our intellectual analysis can never explain the deeper realities of actual spiritual life. We need not philosophically analyze, logically analyze the results or consequences of our actions. Once we are sure that we are doing something unselfish, pure, good for others, we have no selfish motive. We are doing only for the good of others. And there we should stop. We should not push philosophy and logic beyond that limit. Because the point is, logic and philosophy, analytical methods, can be used by everyone for the good and also for the bad, which means they are neutral. So all the great spiritual seekers, spiritual teachers, give this verdict. Logical analysis cannot give us the true picture. But it's like, see, if we sit on the bank of a river and we say we have to cross the river, there's a boat nearby. What we should do? We should enter the boat, and the boat is leaving, we have to go there. If there is a tsunami in the river or something happens, what will happen? So is it safe to cross the river, to use the ferry? We should not logically analyze everything. That's why the deeper mysteries and truths of life, realities of life, can never be fully explained in the light of logic and philosophy. Logic and philosophy can never take you one inch towards real active life. They are good only for removing misunderstandings, but they can never take us to the real destination. So active involvement, doing something unselfish. If nothing can be done, sitting in our room reading a good book, maybe the Philokalia or the autobiography of St. Teresa of Avila. If you read this, and if you continually read this for a month or for a few weeks, suddenly you feel that your mind is now rich. It has got a new food, positive tendencies. And slowly doubts will vanish. These doubts will completely vanish if you read the life and teachings of great spiritual teachers. So that there we need not worry if somebody will suffer because I'm reading in my room, reading Philokalia. No, nobody is going to suffer. So instead of getting physically involved in any actions, let us be mentally involved in reading good books and feeding our mind with positive spiritual food. That's one way to do it. That's true. See, when we have a great regard for a spiritual ideal, for a teacher, when we read books related to these spiritual ideas in waking state, then in dream state, many of these ideas could take concrete forms. That is true. That's why I said, you know, dreams are not exact duplication of waking state experiences, but cannot be completely unrelated. That's what I said. Cannot be completely divorced, unrelated, but cannot be duplication. So people who think of spiritual ideas, read spiritual books, and at least for some time try to live in the world of spiritual ideas in waking state, when they go to sleep, when they dream, some of these memories could project in the mind and could take the form of experiences.
So you could also have precognitive experiences in dreams. You can also have teachings come in dreams.
Yeah. That's true, but you know, you don't. If you get such an experience, then you should have thought about spirituality and spiritual ideas in the waking state. The mind is rich with these ideas. So the mind suddenly projects these ideas in a graphic form in dream state. All this happens in subtle form. That's why no dream experience can be completely unrelated to waking state experience. Cannot be the exact duplication of it, not repetition. People who get spiritual experiences in dream states, suddenly you may see spiritual teachers, you hear things, all because we are thought, and every thought produces its vrittis. Even a flashing thought, reading a book, listening to a lecture, contemplation, all these can create vrittis or modifications in the mind. And they come to the surface. They take concrete forms in dreams, concrete only in relative sense, because everything happens at mental level. They are not really concrete, they are subtle. But then these latent tendencies and impressions that were gathered in waking state, they come to the surface and project themselves as dream experiences. But there again, not exactly in the same form or manner. There will be difference, but they will not be totally unrelated. That's the idea.
So does that account for someone getting initiated?
It could happen. There are such cases. It happened because that person must have thoughts. And again, accumulation of these positive tendencies may not be in this life. That's an important point to remember. The second, the macrocosmic dimension of karmasaya is related to whole life cycle, not one life. I explained this, you know. Karmasaya is nothing but a huge bundle of samskaras which constitute our inner personality. So in its microcosm, it is related to individual, the effect of our actions at the individual level. In a macrocosmic level, it's the effect of our action in a more universal way. I mean, it's related to our whole life cycle, not one life, but several lives, innumerable life cycles. So we may have gathered these tendencies sometime in the past, not in this life. As I said, you know, when we go to a place, when you read a book, when you meet a person, when you listen to an idea, suddenly you get the feeling, I have been familiar with this sometime in the past. That's the idea behind it. That's why Patanjali takes the whole life cycle into consideration when he analyzes the effect of actions, results, etc. That's the idea. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Paramahamsa.